Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event in cooperation with the Science and Technology Forum. We welcome both our listening audience online and on the radio, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Dr. Michael Gazzaniga, who will be speaking on Who's in Charge? Free Will and the Limits of Determinism. Doctor.
I hope you missed my computer when you were... I'm not going to tell you anything in detail tonight. I just wanted to correct our host. This is an overview, and a good way to think about it is... I heard this funny story the other day. Everybody knows about the Presbyterians and their predestination and ideas. And these two Presbyterians are walking along, and one stumbles, falls, and the other guy says to him, "Boy, aren't you glad that's over with?" So I've learned in trying to describe this book that everybody has an opinion on free will. Everybody in the room already has one, and basically they want you to vote on, well, are you for it or are you against it? And depending how that answer goes, they either stay in the room or leave. So it is an opinion that has an immediacy to us, and we all sort of, I think, start our intellectual lives when the penny drops in us and we say, what is the deal? Are we a part of this determined world, or are we somehow independent of that, calling our shots? Own shots. And so the thing to keep in mind is that we care about this, which is a very actually small part of what our brain does. If you think of the gazillion decisions your brain makes on a moment-by-moment basis that allows you to produce a sentence, that allows you to hit a microphone, that allows you to do the simplest act possible, all of the staging and processing that goes on that allows an action to be made goes on outside of your conscious awareness. We're not aware of all these things. And in fact, it's well worked out that when you learn a new skill, the first thing the brain tries to do is bury it into your unconscious so that you don't have conscious processes interfering with its action. And so we have a very, this is a totally made up number here by me. Full disclosure, a very small percent of what the brain is actually doing is under your conscious command and conscious control. But we care about it, because the whole idea with free will is that you, the big you, are responsible, because you're in there calling the shots. And you're going to be held accountable for whatever you do, because you we all feel phenomenally as we sit here, did it, right? So Hollywood, of course, captured this years ago in Men in Black.
Look at this.
What the hell is that?
There it is, the self in there pulling the levers, making the choices that we struggle with all day long. And it leads to the question, well, do we have free will? Is there an us in there that's pulling the levers? That's why the question rose. That's why the claim is, why the debate is so real. And that's what we're going to examine tonight. And one way to start thinking about it is, well, free from what? What do you want to be free from? The philosopher Dan Dennett says, I'll give you all the freedom you want. But actually, when you make a decision, you probably want your brain to work. You want to have it do what you have decided you, the brain, has decided to do. So do you really want to be free of physics and chemistry and all the things that guide our bodies? I don't think so. I think it's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous idea to even think about it. So implant in your mind just the question that you can answer in a number of ways. What do you want to be free from? And what I'm going to kind of roll through tonight is that I'm going to argue it's not a useful concept of free will, that the brain works in a mechanistic way, and I'll show you how neuroscience tends to think about it these days, and that brains do enable our minds, of course, and that you is your vastly parallel and distributed brain. It is that thing in there that is putting together a story about what it is you are and why you do the things you do, and I'll explain that. And that the longer story is that, or the shorter story, depending on how you look at it, is your brains are automatic. Your brains are automatic devices, but hold tight, people are free. And I'll try to explain how I get to that conclusion. And so the larger conclusion is you're responsible. So no late night excuses will work with me when my son comes home. Yeah, you're responsible. Get over it. Okay. So the philosopher Gary Watson gave me the phrase a couple years ago. I think is wonderful. It captures a lot. We are the law. We take the social rules by which we decide to live, and we feel good about those rules because we have a theory about ourselves. We have a belief about what the nature of the human condition is, and because of that, we structure the laws for around us that will guide the social interactions and put limits on it and so forth. And so what we think about things becomes very important in actually developing the culture that we choose to live in. It's not idle thought. It's not idle intellectualism to worry about whether one believes in, quote, free will or not, or one believes in this or that. As we absorb these things, we begin to structure the laws around us, and they have real consequence. And to give you an example of that, you can look at the work of Sharif and Green and Schuller, a group of psychologists, where they basically look at the impact of belief on how people would think about punishment. So they take a group of students, and one of them read a rather neutral passage that doesn't say anything one way or the other about determinism. And they take another group of students and have them read a little of Francis Crick's Astonishing Hypothesis, which is very deterministic in nature. So they've primed these students, one with no prime, basically, and the other primed in a deterministic view. And then they give each group a little chore, which is to punish to a varying degree somebody who was a wrongdoer. How much punishment would you administer to Jones here who did something terrible? Well, the determined people, the people that have been primed to believe in determinism, back off on the punishment. They kind of, why punish the guy? He couldn't help it. And the group that is neutral on this crank it up and really let him have it. Right? So, obviously, these ideas, these consequences, they have consequences for how we think about how we, the kind of society and culture we want to live. And nowhere is it more important in a case that's in all of our on all of our minds when you think about the horrible thing that happened in Tucson. We know we have the agent for the crime here. The question is, what do we want to do with it? How do we think about punishment? Do we think about punishment? Do we think to resolve our retributive impulses? Do we want curative measures? Do we want treatment? Do we just want isolation? Those are the large questions that come out of, ultimately, the beliefs that we have about our nature. And that's, again, why I say these issues, starting with the free issue, down the free will issue, down to actually how the brain works, are, I think, important. So This is a problem that's been around a long time. Lucretius, 50 BC, wrote, again, if all movement is interconnected, the new arising from the old in a determinate order, if the atoms never swerve so as to originate some new movement that will snap the bonds of fate. He was really tied up about this. What is the source of the free will possessed by living things throughout the earth? So he said, of course we have free will. He kind of started there, but he knew about this other stuff. Now, how does it work? And he puzzled this. And he says, okay, the atoms swerve. And he moved on in life. But if you look at the real flow of events in the last 1,500 years, starting with Copernicus, see, you are drinking wine and I'm drinking water. And that's so. So starting with Copernicus and starting with Newton and going to Darwin and Einstein, all of this is pointing towards a very deterministic view of the world. And now comes modern neuroscience, which is not discussing determinism. They're actually in there finding out the mechanisms that guide so much of our cognitive life, our behavioral life, and all the rest of it. We know these things now. And one of the things I'm trying to communicate in this book is to not only should you know them, you should feel them. It's kind of being at home with them, and you realize that when you understand the mechanistic ways of the brain, you just start to look at things a little differently than just kind of, well, knowing that there's a mechanistic side or thinking you know about it and so forth. So that's a personal blurb. So anyway, so here we are with all this history of determinism just building us, and finally we're in this modern time where there's actual demonstrations of it, and it leads to, of course, Einstein, who just flat out says, I do not believe in free will. The awareness of this lack of freedom keeps me from taking myself and my fellow men too seriously, and so forth. Well, it was a little tough. And Francis Crick, probably the greatest living biologist of his time, of this century, this last century, just says there's no free will, it's just all your brain and get over it. And so this is the idea that permeates intellectual life, certainly a lot of scientific life. And what do we really think about it? Is there a way out? Do we really think that we're just pawns along for the ride and it's the brain's doing all the work? That's the question. And so first, many years ago, of course, the physicists, when their invention and discovery of quantum mechanics, that the Newton's laws didn't explain the behavior of atoms, said, look, there's a wiggle room. And Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg believed that we have to shift from this deterministic view to the fact that everything works with a probability. And in that, there is wiggle room to believe in free will. What does that mean? So people have sort of, I go into this in the book, but people have just sort of put that aside because they believe that even though you can talk about non-deterministic processes like quantum mechanics, they can produce something like billiard balls, which follow perfectly the mechanical laws of Newton. And they're deterministic at that level. And so the belief of neuroscientists is that they're going to believe that they will figure out how the impulses and the neural energy interact in particular ways to produce the things that we experience from seeing to hearing to thinking to remembering to thought to you name it, that there will be a growing knowledge about how the brain does all that stuff. So Americans said, let's go after this thing, and North Americans who go after it because there's a lot of Canadians in this story too. But this stage, I want to run the clock back before the present and say how this started. It really helps understand things when you know that this is 50 years ago, 60 years ago. Geez, time's flying. I guess it's more than that even. At Dartmouth College, so it's the pitch for our alma mater here. And there's the great psychologist with the dapper hat, Carl Lashley. And over to the right is Donald Hebb. And these people were the fundamental experimental psychologists who became interested in the brain and wanted to know what this thing is like so we can understand behavior. And Lashley turned out to be sort of a blank slate guy, that the brain comes sort of with nothing in it, that it's all wired up by experience, and it's the contingencies of reinforcement and behavior that build up the story that we all have. And Hebb was more on the other side, that it's the synaptic relationships are important. And if you read his work carefully, there's he already was believing in neural specialization and the like. And so this was all enhanced. The body of work that Lashley brought in was to take rats to do various disconnections, as indicated here, and to try to find brain areas that were responsible for particular kinds of behavior. He wasn't successful on that, and there's a lot of reasons why, but let me just say that he came up with his view of equipotentiality, that the brain could be anything, that it was just a big bowl of mush, and you structured it by the contingencies of your environment. And his buddy in crime was John Watson, who they weren't buddies, but they all knew each other if you go back and trace this all out. And they're all talking, you know, there's how it goes. They really think that NBC and CBS and ABC are different networks with different opinions. Are you crazy? One of my daughters... his job at NBC was to listen to CBS to see if they led with a different story than they did, and if they did, there was a meeting as to why. Anyway, that's a side point. So Watson was a big promoter of this idea that it's the part of the American dream. Anybody can be anything. Let's not get too... believing in the nature part of the nurture equation. His famous line, I might select doctor, lawyer, artist, merchant, chief. I can turn anybody anything you want. And right with him was the great neurobiologist at the University of Chicago, Paul Weiss, who was trying to see how the nervous system formed. And he studied frogs and with various surgical alterations. He basically believed that his work is captured in the phrase, function precedes form. And what that means is that the nerves that grow to the arm grow out diffusely and with no specification. And once the arm starts working as an arm, it gets back specified to the brain that that's an arm neuron. And that was this, and he had a resonance principle about it and everything. But it was all consistent with the story that the brain just sort of, you know, mush, and then the experience of the world writes its story, and then here we are. Well, my mentor was a graduate student of Weiss, and he didn't believe it, or he challenged it. And I like to make this point that actually one of the things scientists do that motivates them is they hear something, and they just say, that can't be how it works. And they go at it. They're going to do it. They're going to test it another way. And it's not that the scientists are endlessly curious at all. It's that they just say, I don't believe that, right? Well, Sperry didn't believe this mush story, right? So he very cleverly launches this field of neurospecificity, getting wired up, as I put it. And he very cleverly started doing a series of experiments, like he took frogs and... he rotated their eyes surgically, so upside down, right? And that would mean that when you hold a fly up, the frog under normal circumstances, would lash out with its tongue to grab the frog. But with the eyes surgically removed, the frog went in the opposite direction, 180 degrees. And it never corrected itself during the life of the frog. The system was hardwired. It didn't seem to have this infinite plasticity to it that was suggested by the earlier work. And Sperry went on through a series of experiments over 30 years to show that how neurons actually get from point A to point B in the brain, how they grow through foreign material, as it were, and specifically hook up to particular parts of the brain. And there's a whole chemical affinity theory, a whole specificity. But the point for our purposes tonight is that he just reversed the whole way of thinking about this and said, look, there's a lot of structure that's built into the brain. It comes with complexity already specifically built in by the genetic mechanisms and the laws of development. There's this thing that is not just a happenstance thing. It comes from the factory with complexity. So, okay, what's in this thing? You know, you got your laptop. Does it come with anything in it? And this is where you start looking at the literature of developmental psychology. And this is René Balogeron at the University of Illinois, who's one of the best developmental psychologists around. And she studies babies. She looks at how babies react to little demonstrations, little drama shows that she puts on in front of them. And we're all in brain science and now involved with this expensive equipment, and MR machines, and physicists doing this and that. And the old psychology department used to have a rat maze. Now we have an MR scanner in our basement. We're kind of feeling our oats, right? Except we have colleagues like Renee who are doing these incredible pieces of research with about $12 worth of stuff. You know, little ducks that squeak at each other. And anyway, so working with Dave Premack, an extremely distinguished psychologist, they asked the question, well, what about retribution? Is the retributive response that we commonly feel, is that built in or did we learn that? Okay? So she puts on a little show for the babies. They're the babies sitting in the infant seat, and she's sitting in front of them. She's recording their smiles and their frowns and all this stuff. And she puts on a little show. First show is that duck A hits duck B, right? Bam. Pause. Baby's looking at this thing. And then B hits A back again, right? What's the baby's response? What's the big deal? Tell me something I don't know. Right? I love that picture. So they go on. They now make it a little more complicated. This can't possibly be built into a baby. These are 12-month-old babies, 14-month-old babies. So what they do is they do a little fancier experiment. They have A hinders B. A goes over and gets in B's way. All right? But B is part of this little social group. B's got a buddy, C. Okay? So A hinders B. Right? Then C goes over and helps A. All right? What's the baby? Oh. What? That's not how it works. What is this? And so you see. You see that you begin to say, well, what's all the stuff that's built into the machine that comes from the factory? And what the developmental psychologists show is this rich array of information that is there, from understanding basic physics to understanding causality in various ways to retribution to fairness. They study them all. And there's just this rich array of evidence. And so you now whisk up to the clinical level and you say, well, if there are all these specific skills, could there be specializations in the brain where if a lesion to a particular part of the brain is going to cause a particular kind of disorder? And, of course, that is the whole experience for people who study humans with neurologic lesions of one kind or another. So they study people with frontal lobe lesions, occipital lobe lesions, back where the visual system is, in the temporal lobe where there's language processes, and up in the parietal lobe where there's, in the right parietal areas, there's really very strange events that can occur with a particular lesion in a particular part of the brain. And one of them is called reduplicative paraamnesia. It's a mouthful, right? And what it is the person is sitting there totally rational and with it, and yet they have this one little flaw. I don't know if that's even the right word, but one little dimension to them due to their lesion is they think they're home when they're in your hospital room. And otherwise, everything's fine. They're reading the New York Times, they're doing crossword puzzles and everything, but you ask them where they are, they think they're home. That sounds preposterous, right? Okay, can't be. You're making that up. All right. So here you go. Here is such a wonderful patient that we studied many years ago.
I hope tonight that this is the fifth day. We started early in the morning.
You look fine.
In the afternoon, they say, you're going down this afternoon, you're going down at 4:30, you're going down at 4:45. I'm ready.
Where are you? She was?
Right now, I'm in Jonesport, Maine, in my house on Island Street.
Are you going to have an operation in your house?
I hope not.
Where are you going to have the operation?
In Slum Kennedy, New York, I hope, with some experts, I hope.
But you're not there now?
No. Well, when I get there, you can ask me and I'll tell you.
Okay.
You tell Ted. Dr. Posner may stay with me all night long as my smoking companion. And every 5 minutes he can say, where are we now? And get this beautiful answer. Slum Kettering, New York City.
Are people been asking you that question?
It's the most amazing thing I ever heard. In the first couple of months, they wanted me to believe it. But after that, they didn't care anything about that anymore. Just say it. You know, it doesn't matter whether you believe it or not.
What do you believe?
I know that I'm Island Street, Jonesport. I didn't buy this house just the flibbity-jibbity. This was my whole life savings.
Okay, can you see this page right here?
Yeah, can you see those cigarettes?
A delightful lady, but it's just a demonstration of how a small lesion can produce a specific cognitive disorder while the entire other rest of the cognitive apparatus is intact and normal. So all this has led to what is called a highly modular view of the brain, that information gets is parallel, distributed, stuck into the unconscious mechanisms of the brain, and it's in there computing all the while, affecting your ultimate decisions and all the rest of it, but it works at this very mechanistic level. Now, you say, okay, that's fine, but I don't believe it. I mean, in some sense, everybody in this room doesn't believe it. I mean, we all believe we're in charge of our actions. That's just kind of in your face about every morning when you wake up. I had too much to drink last night. You know, it's my fault. Whatever it is, you think about it. You think you're in charge of your action. And why is that? So we have to take a look at that. And I'll give you a couple-minute excursion into work that I've done over the years on what are called split-brain patients. These are patients that have their hemispheres divided in an effort to control their epilepsy. And the notion is that if the hemispheres are disconnected and the seizure starts on one side, it won't spread over to the other, so there won't be a generalized convulsion. That was the idea, and it basically worked. So the question is, well, what happens when you split the brain? And over the years, we studied very carefully the disconnection effects, and the disconnection effects are can be represented in this diagram. If everybody simply looks at that little dot between the picture of the snow scene and the chicken claw, you would all see both things, and you would say, if I flash that picture to you, you'd say, I see a snow scene and a chicken claw, right? And what happens when you flash that picture to someone who's had a split brain, they would say, oh, I see the chicken claw. And why is that? Well, the chicken claw is projected only to their left brain, and their left brain is the only part of the brain that speaks, because it's this modularized brain, and that's where the language and speech centers are for most of us. And the picture of the snow scene goes to the disconnected and silent right hemisphere. It does not have a speech mechanism. So when you ask the patient, what'd you see? They say, well, I saw the chicken claw. That's the end of it. Okay. So there it is. There's the disconnection effect, and one could spend years studying that, and I did. But now comes the second question. You redo this kind of experiment, and instead of asking them what they see, you say, look, point to the picture that represents the the object flashed most closely. And so for the chicken claw, the right hand points to a picture of the chicken. And for the snow scene, the left hand points to a shovel. So the split brain patient does this. They point like this. And they've made a real movement, right? This is real time. And so you say to the patient, well, why did you do that? It took us 25 years to think of that, by the way. Why did you do that? And patient says, oh, that's simple. The chicken claw goes with the chicken, and you need a shovel to clean out the chicken shed. Right? So it makes the story up to explain a behavior that it had produced. So why do we think we're in charge? Well, you know, you move your hand, you scratch, whatever it is you do. Well, who did it? Well, I did that. Because the same interpreter system is the thing that builds up your narrative, your storyline, about the way you feel, the behaviors you engage in, and all the rest of it. It tells a story. So it's obviously going to tell a story about who's in charge here. Well, of course I'm in charge, because that's the way it is. Okay, so here we are. It's kind of this view that we've got these automatic brains. We have no problem accepting that mechanical devices that are mechanical are automatic. We have actually no problem thinking that all the cells of our body work in automatic ways. The billions of cells that interact that allow us to function biologically, they all work automatically. They're not being controlled by us or willed or anything like that. But when you start talking about the brain being automatic, people get very nervous. They don't like that idea for all the reasons. It suggests that there is never going to be accountability or responsibility. And what I want to argue is that even though we are knowing and going to know more about the mechanistic ways of the brain in producing all our cognitive states, and we've only, with all the vast amount of information we have now, this is just a little teeny bit. And as our human experience progresses, we're going to know more and more about it. But I'm going to maintain that's fine. That doesn't impact the essential question that we're all interested in, is are we still to be held personally responsible for our actions? And so I'm going to argue it's not so bleak. There's kind of people take this and they go, it's terrible. Yeah. It's not terrible, actually. It's kind of neat when you think about it. So I'm going to make two points and then we'll wind this up. I'm going to argue that cognition works in real time. And I'm going to show you why I think that. And that responsibility arises out of people interacting. You don't go looking for it in brains. So first of all, in this great city, there was a great neuroscientist, Benjamin Libet at UCSF, and he really got people thinking about this because he could demonstrate that you could go in and stimulate a part of the brain in a patient that was conscious and awake. And even though you were directly stimulating the patient's part of his brain that may, say, process information with respect to touch, stimulate the brain, it wasn't until about 500 milliseconds later the patient was consciously aware of the event. So this gave rise to the notion that by the time you become consciously aware of anything, your brain's already done it. And that led to this notion that neuroscientists saying that we're kind of... Jesus. We're trying to catch up with our brain. We're looking at this movie that's already played out. That sort of thinking. And I've, quite frankly, started kind of from that position. And as you'll see, those of you who actually read the book, that at the end of the book I kind of flip on you because I don't think that's how it works. I think it's important to keep this analogy in mind. And Leibniz started talking about this in 1700. He says, there's no way you can figure out how a mill works by looking at the parts. The parts are rubbing up. If you hear this analogy, go into a mill and blow up the parts, and you would just see things rubbing against each other. You would have no idea what the implications of those were for the functional existence of the thing, of actually producing a mill. So that while the parts built the mill had another level, another layer of complexity that was different than the parts. And so with that idea, you come up with the idea that maybe layers interact. There's the neural level that's producing our brain. That's what we all think in modern world. And then that produces the neural level produces the mental level, but that mental level interacts and constrains the brain that produced it. That there's that interaction in real time. And an example of that. So that, what are you talking about? Well, let me give you an example of what that is. If you take a group of patients who are depressed, and you give them pharmacological aid, a serotonin reuptake medication, they will get better in some kind of measured metric. And if you take another group of patients and you just give them talk therapy, they will get better to roughly the same degree. But you put the two together and they really get better out here. And that is a top-down meeting bottom-up. There's an interaction at the level of the mental with a level of the molecular. What is that? What is that? How do those layers interact? That is the scientific question of the time. And what it does, though, is suggest that the model that we've had in neuroscience, where it's the simple causality model that A just goes to B, goes to C, it's a very linear model, we have to switch it if we were trying to understand these mind-brain systems into a more dynamic model, which is, in fact, that A and B interact, that one animates the other, and that it's when that interaction occurs, you start counting the time. And so when you see the nervous activity occurring before you're consciously aware of it, that could simply mean the neurons are warming up for this interplay with the mental layer, and it is that interplay and that interaction that is what we're trying to understand. And we don't understand it now, but that's the problem of the next generation. So finally then, so that brings us up to, you can interpret that as we're making our decisions in real time. The second point and last point is that what about this responsibility question? And I'm making the argument that what we should think of is that responsibility comes out of the interaction of people. It doesn't come out of brains. And so the metaphor is cars are automatic. They're these physical devices. We know all about them. We know how they work. We know all that sort of stuff. And you can study them till you're blue in the face, and you'll never figure out traffic, right? The traffic is another level of organization that comes from cars interacting. And I like to show this picture from Da Nang. Well, I guess I won't because it didn't work. But that you just can't figure out the rules of traffic by understanding the cars. So the same for the brain. Brains are automatic. This is what we're learning and we're showing how they work. What about responsibility? Well, responsibility is a rule from people interacting. It's admission, the rules of admission to the social group. And those aren't to be found in the brain. That's in the social glue of the group at the social level. So you have to, the rule of entry is you're holding the person accountable, they're holding you accountable. And by the way, no network works without accountability, so noted. So with the realization of that we're learning more and more that brains are not free in the sense that we meant it, it's that people are free. This absolutely leaves us with the notion that with the group interactions, we hold on to the idea of responsibility, and we cherish it. So that's all a quick version of what I try to say in this book, and I thank you for listening.
All right, thank you very much, Doctor. I'd like to remind our audience online that you're listening to Dr. Michael Gazzaniga, the author of Who's in Charge? Free Will and the Science of the Brain at the Commonwealth Hub in San Francisco. And now it's time for questions and answers. Go right ahead.
Thank you for a very fine presentation, and I especially like the conclusion where you outlined the interaction between top-down and bottom-up. Let me ask you whether you have a comprehensive definition of free will. I noticed that you started with retribution and worked back to responsibility and accountability, but I could imagine something that looks like free will that wouldn't fit that. For example, if I were to be confronted with two alternatives, a chocolate ice cream cone or a vanilla ice cream cone, and I deliberated and I selected the vanilla and rejected the chocolate, I don't see how responsibility...
There's something wrong with you. Huh?
There's something wrong with me. But would there be any need for responsibility or retribution to be part of the definition of free choice at that particular point?
Well, I would come back to what I'm saying is we don't need the vocabulary of free will to begin to understand why you chose one item versus another. That calculation is based on a rich interaction of your past experience, of the rewards you've received, of your taste preferences, of many built-in aspects to your personality. All that gets calculated by this wonderful thing called the brain, and you go to a particular goal. And understanding that, in none of that, is there a need for this concept of free will. So if you were if you're a Martian coming down here and looking at the human condition and say, these people are figuring out, they're figuring out actually how the brain works. Oh, look at that. They've figured out how actions are formed. Oh, look at this part of the brain. They're doing all this thing. No one would say, well, now we need this concept of free will. It's kind of like putting salt on your food. What we need to put a little free will in this mechanistic story. What? Where'd that come from? Well, it came out of history. It came out of the idea that we wanted to have a sense of responsibility and accountability on the human to separate them from other forces. And now that that's fine, got us through a few hundred years, I'm just saying I think we have to prepare ourselves for another way of viewing it, but I don't think it's so bad. I think it's the essential reason that we are interested in the topic, as I keep saying it, is we do not want to get rid of the concept of responsibility, and that comes from another level, I say. So that's my answer.
I think this is a simple question. The experiment that you showed where the guy was putting the probe in the brain, and you said there was this 500 millisecond gap between the behavior. Yeah. What is the, obviously that's an artificial situation, what is the natural situation that would stimulate the brain that way?
Well, everything. I mean, if I touch your hand, there's a nerve impulse that's going up to a particular part of your, touch your left hand, particular part of your right hemisphere. It's being processed in the part of the brain that's specialized for that kind of information. All that's going on. And Libet's insight was that goes on before you can really know anything about it.
So you're saying any external stimuli is the natural equivalent?
External stimuli are coming in and being processed by the brain continually, all the time.
And yet we're not aware of the external stimuli.
Well, we're aware of the ones we're aware of, but we're not aware of a lot of them either. You know, they're coming in and affecting us constantly. That it's kind of slipped by our consciousness and are in there doing their dirty work.
Okay. The only other thing I had was just that cars are automatic. Seems kind of a strange analogy because there aren't the drivers to cars.
Yeah, no, I know. Give me a break.
I guess it seems like to me a lot of what you said seems a bit conclusory to me. I mean, the woman who had the lesion and it had and this sort of physical impairment on the brain manifested itself cognitively in her belief that she was somewhere that she wasn't. It seems to me that almost answers the question of responsibility. We wouldn't hold her responsible, and as an attorney, this notion of responsibility is extraordinarily important because we bring the full weight of the law against an individual. We hold them individually culpable, irrespective of sort of a larger answer to the question of whether they, in fact, whatever that means, are solely responsible. So we're holding them. So I guess my question is, we wouldn't hold this woman liable for believing that she was in her house. because we admit, we concede the point that she is not responsible. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, and if we see that the physical stuff can have that impact on our cognitive abilities, I won't go through the whole. I assume you see where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
And so my question is, I don't think that we can so easily elide over the question of responsibility, given the social reality of what culpability means in our society. If people aren't really in control, if we don't control our mind, and if there's a deterministic mechanism going on that is much more physical, that is determining things, what is that? What should that mean? What might that mean in some future realm?
So this is a huge question for those interested in the law, of course. And what I'm trying to argue is that we should move on from that framing. And we should determine, gather the rules together, say, look, we can determine that Jones is the agent of the deed. They did it. And let's move the conversation forward to what do we do about it? Right, the notion that like on Loeffner, this man that raised mayhem in Tucson, he clearly was able to follow rules. He made change on the way to the shopping center so that he could pay the taxi guy the right amount of money. Then he pays him, and then he goes bam, bam, bam. And he sent notes out the night before of his intention and so forth. So he's kind of an easy case. But where it gets hard, so I say, okay, he did the crime. Let's not spend a lot of legal stuff on that. Let's look at the mitigation time now. What are we going to do about that type of person in our culture? Do we want to treat him? Do we want to have the retributive response of real punishment? And the reasons for doing that are not to be vengeful, although some people would have that as a motivation, but it's to send the signal out that he did a bad thing and we don't want anybody else doing it. A lot of people deeply believe that who've thought about this. I think within 25, 30 years there are going to be cures for some forms of maladaptive behavior. I think we will have possible cures for people who are psychopathic. Will that be allowed? Someone does a terrible act and if you take this pill, you're back in the normal range of behaviors. Those are all, how we're going to deal with that are all social decisions that we will make as we come to understand what we are. And it's a large discussion. And there's already differences, I'm sure you know. The Italians, for example, are very low on believing in retribution. They're not into it like we are. You wouldn't think that by... I'm Italian, I can say that. But I think that's where lots of good science could be done, and I think lots of good social science could be done, and lots of philosophical and legal work could be done. Okay, how do we structure the response to this? Let's not keep focusing on this diminished responsibility thing, because it has to be an extraordinary situation where the person can't follow rules. And demonstrably, in most of these cases, people are still following rules while they did a terrible thing.
So you would say the capacity to follow rule vitiates determinism?
I think it trumps it all. Strong view, but I'm sticking to it. Yes.
Okay, two quick questions. One is, how do addictions figure in this whole determinism versus free will discussion? So I'd like you to comment on that. And the other, I don't have my information too clear, but I read something about, I think it's the microorganism that causes cat scratch fever. It infects some people and it changes their personality, and at some point somebody posited that this explained the difference between stereotypical Northern European and Southern European personalities. But and given that we are 90% microorganism cells and only 10% human cells, to what extent then would our biota, non-human biota, be controlling our behavior versus our human selves?
Well, I'm going to help you out here. That sounds like a way out question, right?
Okay.
But actually, how the biota in our gut is managing our whole physiology is one of the hottest areas of molecular biology and medicine around. Very, very early days in it, but there's stuff going on there that's influencing maybe our response in our immune system to mutated cells, and there's a whole story that's beginning to come out on that. But how you take that up to the mind, I have no idea. So I won't try to answer that. On addiction, and I can tell you, I don't have the answer to addiction either. I mean, but why people succumb to addictive behavior is, well, on the one hand, they may be biased into it because of some preference, genetically built-in preferences to a particular substance.
Yeah, and to what extent they're responsible given right. their behavior under...
Yeah, well, I would hold them responsible. They're choosing to do it, and to pull that away causes all kinds of ripple effects that aren't good for anybody. But what I was going to say was that as they are drawn into the use of whatever it is, their interpreters going on and building up a story and a defense and a rich belief in the value of responding or having this substance or not having the substance, as the case may be. So there may be an initial biologic draw to something, but then it gets elaborated psychologically in ways that makes it very complex to understand. So that's where I would leave it. It's a big, big topic.
Except there are some doctors who treat addicts who would say that they have as much control not taking something as someone would have control stopping their diarrhea.
There you go.
So are they responsible for their behavior? I guess, you know. Anyway, thank you.
One short comment on your second question about the biota. I think when Mark Twain was writing in the 19th century, and Darwin had just gotten his ideas out, and people were saying that humanity was the height of civilization, he said, you know, maybe actually this is just a race between the microbes that, you know, inhabit human beings and the microbes that inhabited our cousins, the chimpanzees, and the microbes that inhabited the human beings are winning.
This is, none of this is in the book. Just so you know, you got to be rehearsed to answer those kind of questions. You know. Yes.
Yeah. There's a key point in your lecture that is unclear to me, where you said that the social rules and constraints are what essentially give us the rules to say that we're responsible. However, I don't follow this at all in isolation with free will, because it seems to me that if we, in fact, don't have free will, then how can just overlaying social rules and conventions make us responsible or give us any kind of free will? So my question is, isn't social stuff irrelevant? It's really... still comes down to individual free will.
No, you're wrong. So, but you phrased it nicely. So, what? Just get rid of free will. Just never mention it again. All right? It doesn't have anything to do with anything. You have a brain in there that is calculating a gazillion things all the time, information from your experience, your rewards, your punishments. You have certain biases, preferences built into you. You got all this stuff. So when you make a decision, that's what's doing it, right? It's not that you freely chose all that stuff. That's just silly talk.
It's all biochemical and electrical.
Well, I'm saying it's all biochemical. I'm saying that there is this deterministic system in there that allows one to understand what it is that goes into a human decision. Now, one of the things that you learn, you're free to learn, I mean, in that sense, are the rules of social interactions. And one of those rules is that you're going to be held responsible. So if the minute there's two people in the world, you've got rules. If there's only one person in the world, no rules, right? Two people, the rules. And so the rule can be learned by this machine that works so finely to produce this. And that's where it learned the rule from, the social rules of interaction of people.
Oh, I see. Okay, then free will itself is not even the issue.
No.
Okay.
Thank you. We'll get there. Yes, sir.
I'd like to get your opinion on the following claim, which is that free will should not be taken as the opposite of determinism. It's not a useful definition, and that a better definition would simply be to say that humans have the ability to ponder a decision and to make a decision, and that there's no external agent that controls what that decision is going to be. So the issue of determinism is just not relevant.
Well, the question is, how does it work? And the juggernaut that is happening with human knowledge is that it's a very mechanistic system that we're going to understand that explains how it works. And in that sense, it's determined.
Yeah. Dr. Early, in the presentation you passed briefly on the role of quantum mechanics and the essential non-deterministic nature of it. And if I understood correctly, you sort of put it aside saying, well, that's fine at the subatomic level, but at the at the level of a human being, it doesn't apply. I'm curious about that, though, because I understand there's been some interesting research within the last decade or so on the role of quantum mechanics in optics, in cryptography, some other applications. And there's some interesting stuff happening in the last couple of years that get into the issue of causality and time moving backwards and things like that. And I'm just curious if you're aware of any research or if you have any personal feelings on the possibility that there may be some fruit to be borne there by applying quantum mechanics to this question.
Well, one of the other things I've learned on this tour is that there are a lot of people have a lot of beliefs on this one. Some people think that the very existence of the fact of quantum mechanics moves us to this probabilistic world, and therefore there's freedom of action. And there's some people who just believe that, for physicists who say that's just the way it is. And there's other people who say, no, you don't get the point. It's the wrong level of explanation. It's not, those non-deterministic processes can produce deterministic systems. And the level that we're trying to understand this brain thing is in a system that does follow rules. So that's in a shorthand for the explanation. And people just say, yeah, well, I don't believe it. Yeah, I believe it. That's an open issue.
Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question. So, but if you can stay afterwards and answer maybe for about 10 minutes after Dr. Gazanika, we'll be able to answer a few questions.
All right. Reality's a problem, but let's say everything's conceptual in a sense. We have a concept of reality. We have a concept of ourself, what's going on inside. If we look at free will as a subjective expression, something that's talking conceptually about what's going on inside and our experience of what's going on. And we talk about the brain as something observable, also conceptual, but we can share it, measure it, and have an agreed sense of what's going on. Subjective is more vague. I think one can approach free will then by looking at subjective expressions as reflecting something about what's observable, something what's going on in the brain. We don't know what the thought or feeling is yet, but probably we'll know a lot more a few more years down the line. Looking at it that way, it seems to me that the plasticity of the brain and neurons, and whether we're talking about a single cell or whether we're talking about networks of this or that size that are more or less functionally dominant in a certain setting, that free will is perhaps an experience that relates the plasticity, the newness of our networks. We reform our sense of self every night because we have to incorporate the memories of what went on in the prior day.
Well, if you're
so there's a new self meeting a new environment.
Yeah.
And out of the plasticity and newness, we have a sense of free will.
I think what you're saying is something that I think actually falls out of a larger discussion, is that what we're free to do is learn. What we're free to do is to have new experience, have new hypotheses, changing our mental states. That is what we're free to do. If you just choose to sit in the closet and not continue to explore information that will change your beliefs about stuff, will reorder thoughts that you have that you call up, all that is in play, right? But you just don't need the concept of free will. You can say, we want to enhance our cognitive life by gathering more information to have new hypotheses. The brain will all do that for you. It's really great.
So maybe the fact we can learn can stand in place of free will.
That's fine. People are trying to understand that. What does plasticity mean in a highly wired brain? There are people struggling with that question, and there's all kinds of answers right now because we don't have the real answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor, for that great presentation. We want to thank our audience here at the club and our audience online. And one last thought. On a macro scale, when you ask the question about free will, I mean, if you look at it, if Newton is correct, there's the laws of thermodynamics. That is, everything is headed towards entropy. There's all kinds of localized anti-entropic events. They're all decisions of individual minds. That's what biology comes from. That's what other things come from. And so, in spite of all the mechanism, in spite of all the deterministic elements of the mechanism, if those laws were completely in force, there would only be ever more disintegrated atoms and ever more less order. And there's obviously a large amount of localized order in the universe, in spite of a huge mechanistic universe that's hard. And that's, until that's solved, there's the question. Are those minds free to make those decisions, or are they just part of the disintegrating atoms? Right? So now this is the end of another meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 108th year of Enlightened Discussion. We hope you enjoyed it very much.